actually control
Jagata of the moving being, Tastusha, of the being that is dull or stationed in one place, Cha, and Pranena, or the living force, Mukhena, origin of all activities, Pati, master, Prajanam, for all living entities, Chittasya, of the mind, Chittai, by the consciousness, Mana, of the mind, Indriyanam, of the two kinds of senses, Bhakti, master, Mahan, great, Bhuta, of the material elements, Guna, and the qualities of material elements, Ashaya, of desires, Isha, supreme master. Translation, your lordship being the origin of the life of this material world as the master and controller of the living entities, both moving and stationary, and you inspire their consciousness. You maintain the mind and the acting and knowledge acquiring senses, and therefore you are the great controller of all the material elements and their qualities, and you are the controller of all desires. Purport in this verse is clearly indicated that the original source of everything is life. Brahma was instructed by the Supreme Life, Krishna. Krishna is the supreme living entity, and Brahma is also a living entity, but the original source of Brahma is Krishna. However, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Matta Parataram Nanya Kinchadasti Danjaya, O Arjuna, there is no truth superior to me. Krishna is the original source of Brahma, who is the original source of this universe. Brahma is a representative of Krishna, and therefore all the qualities and activities of Krishna are also present in one Brahma. Translation, your lordship being the origin of life of this material world is the master and control of the living energies of moving and stationary, and you inspire their consciousness. You maintain the mind and the acting knowledge acquiring senses, and therefore you are the great controller of all the material elements and their qualities, and you are the controller of all desires. So, as I mentioned yesterday, his statements are true in a limited way in referring to Brahma, but actually these statements apply to Vishnu, not to Brahma. But unfortunately, Hiranyakasipu doesn't recognize Vishnu. And even if he applies these terms to Brahma, he is not very sincere in that also, because even though this would indicate a Supreme Lord, he also doesn't believe that Brahma is the Supreme Lord, because he's just got a post and he can be kicked out of his post, and Hiranyakasipu can take his post. So in one sense, his words are true, but they're also false in the sense he doesn't really mean them, and they're also applied to the wrong person for his own purposes. Just as sometimes a devious person may flatter a leader and give him all sorts of praises just in order to please him, and then when he gets the trust of that person, then he may assassinate him or something and take over power. So this is more or less Hiranyakasipu's strategy here. But nevertheless, these statements are true in relation to the Supreme Lord. Here he says that you are the controller of all the moving and non-living living entities, and you control their pranas or their life. This actually applies to the Supreme Lord. But now, of course, the jivas are all eternal, so they have no origin, so the Lord does not create them at a certain point in time, since they're eternal. Nevertheless, they're all under the control of the Supreme Lord, even though they have independence or free will. Still, their very existence depends on the permission of the Supreme Lord. Okay? So if you were to say don't exist, they wouldn't exist. But he never says that. And their very consciousness and their ability to know and to act and to desire, etc., which is inherent in the jiva itself, that also is dependent upon the Lord's ability to know, to act, to desire, etc. So the Lord has his qualities, and the qualities in the jiva are a reflection of that. So they follow after the Lord's qualities. So this is mentioned in many places in the Shrutis, in the Upanishads. The eye acts because of the Lord, or the other senses act because of the Lord. And therefore it is said that the Lord is the eye of the eye. He is the essence of the eye of the living entity. So his seeing creates or establishes the seeing of the jivas. The knowing of the Supreme Lord, his consciousness establishes the jiva as a knower, a conscious being. So that is why the jivas are called amsa. Not in the sense that they are cut off pieces, not in that sense they are parts, but in the sense that they are dependent upon the Supreme Lord. So the Lord is called the Amsi, and the jivas are called the Amsa. We should not, of course, confuse that term with another type of Amsa. There's another type of Amsa called the Swamsa. That means various forms of the Lord, such as avatars. They're called Swamsa, Swamsa, the Lord's own parts, which means they're non-different from the Supreme Lord. They're also not cut off pieces of the Lord, because the Lord is only one. But they're other forms of the Lord. Whereas the jiva is not a Swamsa. He's not integral part of the Lord. He's not the same as the Lord. Different. So he's distinguished, and he's called a Vibhinamsa, a separated part, a different type of part, a different type of dependent being. The Swamsas are called Amsas because not they're dependent on the Lord, because they're all the Supreme Lord, but because they only manifest part of the qualities of the Lord. So in that sense, they're in an inferior position to Krishna, who manifests all the qualities. But they're all one Lord. We cannot separate them in any way. So that's another type of amsa. So the jiva has similarity to the Supreme Lord. And of course, Brahma also has similarity to the Supreme Lord. So in the Nectar of Devotion, there Rupa Goswami, in enumerating the qualities of the Supreme Lord, he gives 64 qualities to Krishna and 60 to Vishnu, 55 to Shiva, and 50 to living entities. But those qualities are in Krishna, they're also in the living entity. But when they're in the jivas, it's just bindu bindu matra, very, very little quantity. They manifest these 50 qualities, but in small degree, because they're different from the Supreme Lord. They're only jivas. And this is, of course, in keeping with the idea that the definition of the jiva is anu. He's small particle. He is not vibhu. He's not all-pervading everywhere. He does not contain everything. So he has some sort of limitation in comparison to the Supreme Lord. The jiva has qualities, or can manifest qualities like the Supreme Lord, but in small quantities, so it's not exactly the same. And he cannot manifest all the qualities, only 50 out of the 64 qualities. This, of course, is only an enumeration. It's not an absolute number. There's obviously infinite number of qualities in the Supreme Lord. We can never count them all. But just to give an idea of proportions, we have 50 and 64, etc. These things are there. And it is also said that these 50 manifest more prominently in devatas than in regular jivas. Of course, what does this mean? It doesn't mean because they are simply sattvic beings, but because they're also devotees. So the devotees will manifest these qualities, whereas the non-devotees will not manifest these qualities at all. So these qualities are not material qualities. They may look like material qualities, but they're not material qualities because they manifest in the Supreme Lord. So they can never be material. So we'll have a similarity of qualities in the material world. So we look at Krishna's qualities. He is clever, or he has compassion, he is skillful, etc. So we have these qualities. So it looks like qualities that are in the material world. On the other hand, the material qualities are products of material nature. They're different. So similarity is there, but also difference is there, because one set of qualities is intrinsic to the Lord, the other set of qualities is a product of Prakriti. Prakriti manifests in sattva good some very nice qualities. So the qualities of the Supreme Lord are completely different from that. They're actually the origin of the qualities we see in the material world, which will manifest in sattva gun. But they're also different because origin is different. So we shouldn't confuse the two sets of qualities. And when we say that the devotee has so many qualities, there's a whole list of qualities given in the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam, qualities of a devotee. Many of those qualities are the qualities that will also be seen in a jnani or in a person of sattva-guna. So we shouldn't think that these are the same qualities, because they're not. The qualities that will manifest in the devotee are spiritual qualities, like the Supreme Lord's qualities, and not material qualities. So we should never compare the two and think that, therefore, because these qualities are there, oh, that's sattva-guna, so we should cultivate sattva-guna. So, bhakti does not mean to cultivate sattva-guna qualities. It means that one manifests spiritual qualities by the process of surrender to the Lord. That's all. So therefore, in the Nectar Devotion, Rupa Goswami notes that cultivating good qualities of sattva-guna is not an anga of bhakti. So of course we have qualities like tolerance, etc., and the qualities of a brahmana. So it's not the sadhana of bhakti to cultivate those qualities. That's for people in the modes of material nature. But there are similar qualities manifest in a devotee. So we see that the person in bhava, for instance, the 13 qualities of a person in bhava mentioned in the Nectar Devotion. So one of the qualities, yes, he's very tolerant of the material world. That's different from the tolerance that is cultivated in sattva guna. So, therefore, we should distinguish between the qualities of the devotee and the qualities of a person in sattva guna, and not think that they're the same thing. They look the same, but they're different. And of course, that is because the qualities originally are in Krishna. And therefore, we have a reflection of these qualities in the material world. Nevertheless, all these qualities in the material world are ultimately rejected as being material. So sattva-guna is better than tamo-guna and raja-guna, but it's also a cause of bondage. So if we cultivate sattva-guna qualities, we bind ourselves to the material world. Therefore, the idea is not to cultivate good qualities, sattva-guna qualities in bhakti, but rather simply to practice bhakti. And through that, qualities manifest. Spiritual qualities will manifest, which are superior to the material qualities. How does that manifest? That manifests in the form of qualities which are related to service to Krishna. Why do these qualities manifest in a devotee? Because it's favorable for serving the Supreme Lord. So that's why these qualities will manifest in the devotee. Yeah? Whereas in the material world, why do those qualities manifest? So they are byproducts of the gunas. Tamagun manifests certain qualities, Rajagun manifests certain qualities, and Sattvagun manifests certain qualities. So what is the purpose of those qualities? It creates steadiness in that particular guna. By those qualities, if you have those qualities and indulge in those qualities, then you become fixed in that particular guna. So that's what those qualities do. So you cultivate sattva-guna qualities, become stuck in sattva-guna, which is better than being stuck in tamaguna rajaguna. But nevertheless, it binds you to gunas in the material world. The qualities manifested through bhakti do not bind you to the world because they're spiritual. Rather, they bind you to Krishna. Because they're all manifested for service to Krishna, they help you increase your service to the Supreme Lord. So rather than binding to the material world, they keep you away from the material world, because they're all related to service to Krishna. So that is the difference between those qualities. So the Lord is the source of all the qualities of the living entities, and the consciousness of the living entity, his capacity for knowledge, his capacity for acting, everything ultimately is under the Lord. And once the jiva gets his material body, those senses and the subtle body and the gross body and the senses and etc., mind, intelligence, also are under the Supreme Lord. Not directly, indirectly. So he has the agents. There's Paramatma, and beneath Paramatma we have devatas. And so this means that the senses are able to operate in the material world. So it is described several places in the Bhagavatam, at least six times in the first two cantos, and later on also, a description of the Vishwarupa, in which it describes the huge form of the universe, which is actually imaginary. It's not a real form of the Lord, because it's made out of material elements. So in that form, there are all the material elements, and there are the senses, and the sense objects, and the gross body with the counterparts of senses, like the eye and the ear, etc., were actually not the senses, because the senses are subtle. So these things exist and are described in relation to a huge universal form. And before the universe actually is populated with living entities or anything. So the purpose of that form is to show that the senses of the universe, or everybody in the universe, do not operate until a certain structure is produced. That is, we have the sense, the object of the sense called the tanmatra, and the sense devata. So that is why in the listing the elements of creation, we get a whole series of 10 devatas, 10 senses, and tanmatras corresponding. And the three interact with each other. And that produces sense perceptions. They don't exist, or they cannot operate, however, without the gross body. So these things operate in relation to a particular body. So therefore, there's an eye on the universal form, and there's a foot on the universal form, etc. And then in relation to that, we get the devata, the sense, and the sense object. However, even then, the universal form can do nothing. It just stands there. And only when the Supreme Lord enters, then everything becomes active. The senses can operate. The universal form can see and hear, etc., and speak, etc. So the fire devata is in charge of the speaking, etc., in the throat. And the sun is in charge of, that's the devata. Sun devata is in charge of the eye and seeing, like that. And then when the Supreme Lord enters into the form, universal form, then he can see and hear, etc., and move. So the whole purpose of that is to show that the living entities, even if they're endowed with their subtle and gross bodies, can do nothing unless the Supreme Lord is present. His presence alone makes everything operate. He doesn't have to think about doing it, he doesn't have to involve himself in doing it, but he has to permit it. So his permission is there, and everything operates in the body. So we have the Supreme Lord as Paramatma, then we have the sense David as there, and we have the senses all structured according to the plans of the Supreme Lord and Brahma, and then the living entity can operate in the material world as a moving being or a non-moving being, like a tree or whatever, and they can carry out their life. So all of the living entities in the material world are jivas with bodies, but they cannot operate those bodies properly and get their enjoyment in the material world unless the Supreme Lord permits it all to happen. So this shows the superior position of the Supreme Lord. Nothing can operate without the Supreme Lord. So that more or less is represented here, where Hiranyakasipu is praising Brahma as actual origin of the operation of the senses and the life force and consciousness, etc., of the jivas. He's saying, you're the master of all of this, of the living entities, and you're the controller of everything here. So, secondarily, of course, Brahma carries out this function because he creates the different types of bodies for the living entities. But he does not create those elements. He does not create the senses. The senses and the sense objects and the sense devatas, they manifest through prakriti. And prakriti does nothing also. Prakriti cannot manifest those things. Unless Vishnu glances over prakriti, then prakriti begins to manifest all of its elements. So Brahma takes those elements and combines them together and makes planetary systems and makes bodies for living entities. So that's why it's called the secondary creator. Just as the potter does not create the clay, but he uses the clay and produces a pot. So Brahma creates the living entities out of the materials which are manifested through the agency of the Supreme Lord when he so desires. Brahma is a creator in a sense, but secondary creator. So behind everything, ultimately, the Supreme Lord is there. He's the controller of everything. So that is the actual position. So unfortunately, in the material world, people are a little ignorant. So even though they want to, or they intuit some superior force, usually they don't go far enough. So they'll go to a certain level. Oh yes, this devata is in control of everything. But behind the devata is Supreme Lord. They don't understand that. So they get to the first level. That's better than nothing. And therefore those people worship devatas. And we have the Karmakanda section for them. They worship devatas and get their desires fulfilled, etc. But it's partial vision. It's not a complete vision. So therefore the Karmakanda section is not complete. It's only one section. And above that we have the Supreme Lord. So it has its purpose, the worship of devatas, but it's not the final truth. So therefore it said we don't, Shruti Shastra Ninda, we don't criticize the scriptures for having these parts in them, but we understand the position, why they're there, and we understand their position. So in this way, we don't criticize the Karmakanda or anything, but we also don't take it as absolute. I understand it's a secondary principle for less advanced people. Okay.
And it's by your means of the distributed all the universes in different proportions. We have explored it in one of the universes.
All the elements, the basic elements are there in all the universes. And the proportions apparently are also manifested. The elements in themselves are not complete. They have to combine, each element has to combine with a certain proportion of the other elements. So the earth element has to combine with the fire element and the water element and the air element in a certain proportion. This is called Panchikarana, made up of five parts. So we have the principal element, and then we have all the other parts of the other elements there, and that makes what we know as the water element or the thing. So they're pure in one form, and then they get mixed together, and then those mixed together elements, they form bodies, etc. So that principle is there in all the universes. The same material elements, the same subtle elements, So we get similar gross bodies and similar subtle bodies of living entities. And of course then we get planetary systems made of elements also in similar manner. You're saying that they should become separately qualified for the, what, material work or what? Yeah. In devotional service. Should he or shouldn't he? What are you saying? What's the question? Material qualifications can be useful in certain aspects of bhakti. For instance, if one's an engineer and you know engineering, then you can construct a temple. If you don't know engineering, you may make a mistake and then you waste your money or whatever. So in that sense, it's useful. Huh? It's not an absolute necessity. Everybody has to be qualified in that way, because the ultimate service is beyond these qualifications. That is simply hearing about the Lord and chanting the Lord's name, etc., which doesn't require qualifications of PhDs or anything. So these other services we can do, and they may require qualifications. So if you have a qualification, better. If you don't have a qualification or can't get it, better don't do that service if it requires that qualification. So it's only practical matters. But as far as the advancement of bhakti is concerned, that's completely different. Qualification there is simply faith. These other things, as part of our service, we do, but if we don't do the bhakti along with that, then these qualifications are also useless as far as bhakti is concerned. Stage of bhakti does spiritual qualities manifest in a devotee? Well, in the nectar devotion there, it says that we have first two qualities which begin to manifest in sadhana bhakti. So we have kleshagni and subhada. So kleshagni is removal of karma, desire, etc., all the suffering, all of the stuff, anarthas, etc. So negative things are removed. And subhada means manifestation of good qualities. But as I said, good qualities doesn't mean sattva-gun, because what is so special about bhakti producing sattva-gun? It's not, the purpose is nirguna. So therefore, good qualities ultimately means the spiritual qualities begin to manifest. So these two aspects, kleshagni and subhada, begin to manifest in sadhana-bhakti. And of course, they become more complete in bhava bhakti and prema bhakti. But they begin to manifest even in sadhana bhakti. In contrast to this, if you practice jnana or yoga, the goal is not to cultivate any qualities of the atma, because quality is associated with material qualities, so therefore they avoid all qualities. So in the cultivation of jnana or yoga, when they do reach perfection, they get rid of all qualities. All the material qualities and no spiritual qualities. So therefore the atma, when you realize atma, you just realize absence of suffering, absence of karma, absence of rebirth in the material world, absence of old age, absence of the material body. But you don't have any positive qualities. Other than that, you're conscious. That's it. So that's the goal, and that's what is achieved through jnana or yoga. So no spiritual qualities manifest at all. So, in devotion, because one is establishing a relationship with the Lord, and the Lord is full of qualities, naturally, the devotee also begins to develop qualities like the Supreme Lord, but in small quantity. Association breeds similar qualities. Well, in any case, yes, the material mind is, in yoga, that's what happens to stop the functioning, the mental functions completely. That is the goal of yoga. When all the mental functions stop, that is, thought processes, desires, hatred, ahankara, etc., stop. What's left? Atma. Atma, just being conscious, that's it. So that's the goal of the yogi. The goal of the bhakta is to use the mind positively, not negatively. The goal of the yogi is to just stop the mind, because they are aware of its negative qualities of producing karma and desires, etc. So stop the mind. The devotee, on the other hand, can use the mind. So he uses the mind to think of the Supreme Lord, to engage himself in the Lord's service. And, of course, when he attains perfection and he leaves the material world, he also leaves that mind behind. But simultaneously, in his cultivation of bhakti, he develops his spiritual desires, his spiritual mind, his spiritual intelligence, etc., with spiritual qualities. Okay? And that takes the place of all this material stuff. So then he doesn't need that material mind anymore.
You know, the mind has spiritual qualities. The devotee leaves the mind behind, which is filled with material qualities. Mind merges with the total.
Yeah, subtle elements merge with the total mind and the universe. Well, but those qualities will all be gone already through the process of bhakti, because it's purified the mind of karmas, desires, except through anartana vritti. So all that will be destroyed already. So all that's left anyway is the element mind element. That's all that's left for him. And that merges into the mind, total mind of the universe. Well, the Supreme Lord always desires. It's whether we appreciate the Lord's desire or not. That's the main thing. So part of it, of course, is the Lord's mercy. Part is the individual's own choice. So when you choose, then the Lord helps you. When you don't choose, then the Lord's neutral in the matter. But the Lord, of course, wants all living entities to advance, and therefore he gives them opportunities. If they don't take the opportunities, that's the free will of the jiva. So there's the element of choice also for the jiva. It's not that everything's dependent on the Lord. Just as the same person who says, well, when the Lord wants me to, I will, he doesn't operate that like that in the material world. He goes to university, he studies for so many years. He's not saying, well, when the Lord wants me to study, I'll study. He doesn't do that. And when he wants me to get a job, then I'll get a job. No, he goes out and searches for a job. He doesn't just sit there. So, the same for spiritual life. Well, it's difficult to do that, because birth after birth, the mind gets filled with desires, and they'll stay with the jiva, life after life after life. So it's difficult to erase all those things immediately. The process of yoga will do that, but it may take thousands of years again of practice to do that. So therefore, it's a very difficult process to empty the mind completely. ultimately, for liberation, yes, the mind has to be completely empty. No. Well, in most cases, no. Only at liberation. No, because unless you're blessed by the Lord suddenly, not really, because you can say, of course, in deep sleep, yes, the mind is inactive. But that's not a voluntary state. And then again, you dream, and then you come back to waking state again. So we can say suspension at a certain point in time in deep sleep, but it's not a conscious thing. And again, the desires will appear, etc. So they're suspended for a little while in deep sleep. So that's all. That's the only condition, as far as the material world is concerned.
Tras un par de minutos.